Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about podcasts while driving. I'm going to talk about making a research paper, or not a research, well, what I've done is I've begun to read a few education papers, realise, oh, no, this is not research standard, you know, the way that they tell it. It's more a stream of consciousness. Compared to a research paper, education papers are a stream of consciousness type of dialectic. I think that will be closer to it. This is where there's a set of reasoned arguments. So the data's not there, and it's more basically a script or a play on how to do things. So I've sort of read that and decided that I would, how I could do that. And it's good in certain senses, because, you know, you have this sort of fairly awkward thing to produce. Like, so in research, you produce something and it's research quality, and it's in education, you don't necessarily produce research, you produce something of value to education. In that, there are different ways of doing it. You could measure it, write it up as a research paper, or you could explain how it's used. And so often, I've only read one or two education articles, they give an example of how it's done in class and what goes in class. And in that case, I've come to the point of, yeah, I'm ready at this point in time, sort of slowing down with my sensor development. This crossing across here. So I'm going to stop a little while because I've got to stop up the library and, oh, I don't know, pick all these various things up. So you'll hear me do that. Okay, just checking it up. And oh, it's going to be a bit of a squeeze through here. There's community transport, everything's happening. It's a beautiful, hot, sunny day in Australia. I'm at the stage where I'm just burning in the sensors, that is, running the sensors in and just checking how they go. So fortunately I've got this thing, so just to get up to it, there's the Internet of Things, and I've decided that I'm going to have an Internet of Things, a thing that it will do whatever you want in class. You know, go in class and you can wrap it up, pop it up, put it in your school case, take it home, run your experiment, take it up. It's all done. It's sort of a Fitbit, Internet of Things. And so I've got these sensors running on it. Now, of course, what happens is that they know there's a sort of a market going on. And so if you've got a Fitbit, you're going to have the best sensor possible. You know, a lot of energy. Now, that's not necessarily in education. In education, you've got many cheap sensors, and so they're all doing their own things. And sort of just seeing how repeatable they are. That is, if they're wrong, do they repeat the same thing wrong? Because then you can compensate for it. Or if they drift, how much do they drift by, and all that type of stuff. So that's a very interesting thing to get up. And so I'll just go to where I am at the moment. And of course, while I'm waiting that to happen, I'm beginning to write from an education research paper. So continuing on this, I've just delivered my library book here. So it's for me, for you in podcast land, it sounds like no time whatsoever, but it's taking me a minute or so to do that. I've got to go off and go up to the local shopping centre, and then what else I have to do? I have to go and buy this really annoying little component. I just hope they don't charge a bucket for it, JCar Electronics down there. Then I have to, I'll have to see what I can get done. Okay, that was 7. Keep a tight schedule on this. Yeah, look, there's a standard thing, is that when you get your sensor data, you can run it over and over again and check that you've got everything's super stable. Now, for the thermocouples. So a thermocouple basically is two different sorts of wire, and you solder them at the top, and then you measure the voltage at the back. And what happens is that when you heat any sort of metal, it pushes the electrons away from the hot end, and pushes the electrons away at different rates for different metals. And so you can use that as a temperature probe, where you just get the it sort of equals everything up, except it's the you know, the temperature at the very end which determines it. So you've got a thermocouple. Now, the end result is that these thermocouples are shockers. You know, they rust in water, they've got a limited range, the chips are bad, but the bottom line is that they're very reliable, repeatable. So they've got exactly the same error there, which is, you know, you'd want to think that, like, that's right. So I'm just going to stop at the moment. Then at the end, after this short thing, I'll tell you the big surprise about mass measurement. So we'll just talk about that in a second. Okay, back again. I'm going to see. I've got to get back and pick someone up by 2. So I'm going to see if I can get down to Penrith. It's 40 minutes. It's going to be a tight turnaround. We'll see how it goes. See how far I get. I have to be really down there by this stage. I've got to be down there in just an incredibly short amount of time. I don't think I can just really think about it. I want to get these components. Oh no, look, I think I'll just rest and relax and talk about it because I've got sufficient. So what's happening is that there's these components which you can buy to stick in, I think 1.25, a tenth of an inch, or probably a 20th of an inch. I think there's 20 an inch points and inches. Yeah, it's 20 an inch points. And unfortunately, I've broken some. I kind of think that it really doesn't matter. I'll just go home and produce it and try and finish this off and talk to you about it. Okay, so the thing about is there's thermocouples, and the simple thing is that for about $1 more, you can buy the proper thermocouples. I just have to know where to look and just have your effort out involved in doing it. This is a different company from Banggood. Banggood it buys really factory seconds from China. So what you do is you get it. So this is one of the things. I've got the 5 thermocouples. 3 are good, 2 are bad. They're good. They all are good, but they're just 2 of them read the wrong number. So one can imagine that what happens is that they're doing some basic quality control. I don't think they possibly do quality control of things so cheap, but they might do a sample and might reject a whole batch. And that when they reject the whole batch, that's what goes to Banggood. So the Banggood would possibly be able to buy. So Banggood. So I'm trying to think out about what it is. So you do get, unfortunately, very low quality stuff from them. Well, it depends what it is. The chips. You know, the chips are, you know, fairly high quality. So if you've got an end-of-an-era chip like these chips I've got for the thermocouples, you know, that's the end of the era. I don't think anyone's producing 666 technology or 6625 technology anymore. It's moved on to now for load sensors. It's a slightly different story. First off, I bought these very small, expensive live load sensors, and then I bought for about $5 each. This includes the sensor and the electronics, $5 each. I need 3 of them. These bigger load sensors, and they're bigger and more robust. So the light ones have very thin wires. These ones, the cheaper ones, have thicker wires, a bit more robust, and easier to manage and screw in and get going. It's a simpler load sensor, but nonetheless, unlike the thermocouples, which are reliably, if they're bad, they're reliably bad, which means that you can just put in a computer algorithm and correct for them and make them absolutely perfect. The load cells, are inherently shit. And you know what's going on about it. So they're really good. They're at probably 0.1 gram, a hundredth of a gram accuracy, right? And resolution, that might be it. However, they drift with time and temperature, and they drift unreliably. And you know what's going on. And of course, you research a bit. And of course, nowadays, they're not using that technology anymore. That's yesterday's technology. This is why it's so cheap. So these are little cantilevers, and they've got four variable resistors on them, four stretch resistors. So if I pull a wire, a very, very fine wire, and if I pull it, it will stretch, become longer and thinner. And so that process of stretching it will change its resistance. And so you can measure directly force with the length on a piece of wire, which is all okay, except the whole thing is encased in epoxy. And epoxy is this huge, big plastic gump thing. So the epoxy takes a while for this force to work through it. So it's got a slow response time. And the epoxy has got its own life. If you heat up the epoxy, it will stretch. It's sort of like this nightmare material to work with. And so you know, one could think of putting it in a warm environment, getting it. But what's happened is that if you pay 50 times as much, pay $130 a sensor, so I would be paying an incredible amount of money for it. You can get these voltage ones, and three wires in, direct voltage in, and fast response time, no drift, absolutely solid, no epoxy, it's all solved. So I'm just trying to get used to that going across. Now I'll just go in and talk about the I'll just wait here. What's the time? 1:23. We'll talk about the research paper I've written. So what's happening is that I've got this on. So I've got the basic components together working separately, and I've just upped it, and it's recording the information. And so now I'm reading educational research papers and working out how to do it. So here's the education paper as it goes. The very first section is that I know that I want to cover Bunsen, and the point I really want to make to people is there's no really research, nothing phenomenally new about going to user forums and working out how to put these things together. What is unusual is that people are putting a group of these things together. That have we got five temperature sensors, three this, and putting it all together in a kit, which is easy for education. So that's an unusual step. But the technology itself, at no point is this sort of groundbreakingly new stuff. It's just an application of it in a particular area. So as it's a two-prong approach, one is getting into schools, but which you can physically do, you can drive up and do it. You also get it through the teacher process, and trying to understand the psychology of the teachers, having been one myself and seeing how they react badly. And that, look, having reacting badly is actually an asset, because I know what to fight against. But also reading education research articles or education in an education journal, I realise that it's nowhere near there's sort of really a fundamental, possibly a lack of understanding what science is and why you're educating. I think one real thing is that I think anyone who's really into science, the idea of educating people in science is a bit of a mystery. It's almost like you take them along one track to one destination, and they've got to arrive somewhere totally different. That is they have to realize that they're uneducated. It's sort of like there's a whole set of negative things that they have to... They're not necessarily negative, they're falsely positive things. I don't know, to get through. So how I started up is the article is, I say, imagine Robert Bunsen, 1811 to 1899, comes into a school laboratory, and he will recognize a Bunsen burner, because he had invented his invention from 1855, his Bunsen. Now, this mentions the word Bunsen several times. It also starts to classify back in history Bunsen. And he said, he will look up at a periodic table, but he won't recognize it because the actual current form of the periodic table happened in 1915. So this is sort of a way of actually doing the context with it rather than say the majesty of time. You've suddenly got the interest, and you then have the class. Then he says he recognizes two elements that he discovered. So this adds a bit of facts that the Bunsen burner, being very famous, discovered new elements, and that's rubidium and cesium. And then you introduce again the actual concept of this fantasy concept, and your students ask what's the origin? And rubidium is Latin for deep red, and cesium is the Latin for sky blue. Yeah, that's it. And so that's a curious piece of information. Now, a teacher listening to that will say, oh, well, that's a very engaging way to put those two dot points down. Bunsen, he made use of a Bunsen burner and did this. And coming in, I've said, well, now think of Roberta Nesnub. Nesnub is Bunsen spelt backwards, Nesnub. And she comes in, she's a parent, and she offers to do an in-service of you about this latest technology that she's developed. Now, that immediately is this step through, that there is this fantasy thing which you are in a place to accept, and that you're actually using the teaching methodology to teach. I'm getting really back into it. This is, dare I say, exactly where the teachers, I suppose, fall down, in that they have learned a methodology to teach, but that's not the methodology to think. So they think they have a model of how people learn, and that model is a good scaffold for coherent thought and tests, a systematic way of teaching. But that in itself is not sufficient to actually nut your way through every problem. So you may have a preferred recipe, a way of doing it, like playing a golf round or something like that. But it's actually not going to actually get you across the line. I want to say, you have a golf field and you know to hit the ball in certain ways to certain places to win the day. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're highly skilled or know about playing golf fields in general and stuff. You've learnt for that practice. And so this is very much in terms of teacher thought, that if you propose a statement to a teacher right up, their answer question is not is it right or is it wrong, because that's not, can I teach this? This is the fundamental aspect. So if you've got to actually present the information. So this information about this new Internet of Things is the idea of the classroom being very advanced compared to the past time, but in the future, that someone in the future will want to come in and have a discussion, and there are things that are not going to be understood for certain reasons. So Bunsen is not going to understand the periodic table because he hasn't seen these advances. you, the teachers, are not going to understand the Internet of Things simply because you haven't seen the various points. And then I say, well, you know, we can't actually go through a whole article where I talk about Roberta Ness Bunsen Knob. Ness Knob. I have to give her basic notes. So the first sequence is that his basic thing, it will, it's Wi-Fi, it lasts a week, students can build it, and it basically does everything. Then a technical data sheet. Now the technical data sheet I start to give by deliberately not going out of the line. So if you want to write an article for teachers, you have to put everything in a table which reinforces the teacher's misbelief of the way scientific tables are produced. So one of the things they do for a scientific table, it must have a border, it must have everything lines between it. Now what's happened is that in science, if you read open a science paper, a table doesn't have a border, it has a single line across it. And it's the minimum number of lines such the data can be displayed. So there's not columns drawn and all this type of stuff. So it's a minimalist thing. So I have that there. And I also, for units, I think milliamp hours, I have the midpoint. And so there's a whole series of scientific conventions which aren't there. Now, I'm not telling people off for not doing it. I'm just saying that as part of Roberta Nesnub, she is going to be a proper scientist. You can be upset with her, but she is going to do it properly. So this takes away, am I doing it wrongly? No. This person, for some reason, they may be wrong. How dare they tell teachers how to do it? That's what it is. So it's not how to, it's sort of deflecting in a certain way. And it goes through then the list of sensors, as is now, the mass and size of it, so they can get a view of it. And then a list of standard scientific experiments. And this is heat diffusion, boiling water, melting ice, titration, just a few, burning steel wool. They're basic things where it's done in this network more easily. Then I have to get into the discussion of discussion, not of burning steel wool, but the discussion of what are the big ideas here. Firstly is the internet, the use of the internet. This is agent to agent, that is, I as a purchasing agent with money connected to the internet, and I will buy something. So it used to be between two people, and then between a group, and then there was data being dumped into the internet for public use. This is like the stock exchange, stock prices, weather, general things are pumped out by organisations as a public good, as part of the product that we go. Which, you know, the information is a product. Now, the information directly is a product. Now, the Internet of Things is that your toaster and various things start to produce data, and the value of it is sort of not exactly, you know, instantly clear. You know, if you were building a toaster from scratch 20 years ago, to make it Wi-Fi enabled would be actually absolutely mad. But now, you've got the thing is that the chip is, it costs no more to put the chip on there. It costs you nothing more to do it, and that people are selling toasters. And to differentiate, the toasters have matured, and so the actual process improves such that
you have a Wi-Fi toaster. You have a Wi-Fi solar cells, Wi-Fi cell pool pumps, Wi-Fi sensors, and this, the actual network of sensors going up to actually start to draw a picture. So your pool pump may only come on when it's there's sufficient sun, and start to add intelligence. Now the thing is that the Wi-Fi, the Internet of Thing, the fundamental thing is that it's just the Wi-Fi. The Internet contains the computers and the intelligence, which are there anyway, waiting for you to come up and order your meal. And the rest of the time it's just sitting there clicking over. So we're using excess capacity, and we're using the remote computers. Now, what I'm saying is that the constraints, which says something on a toaster has to be small, unobtrusive, and unseen, we can change those constraints for these the school stuff. It's you can see everything, and it can have a lot of sensors, and it can have a lot of bad sensors. So for a toaster, you need the basic to the nearest 10 degrees, but you need a very high, actually quite high quality sensors for school. Now, the point is that if you have a sensor which can detect micrograms, and you put, say, an icy beaker on your stand, what will happen is that it will start to increase in heat. It's increase in weight because of condensation. So that's it's a whole series of things to reposition it. But it is to say you could ask the question, what could be done? Do we need the Internet of Things, whatever it is? And we could go through a few processes, and majority of people have said no. And this is not in the paper, but majority of people said no, I don't have to do this. And then the question goes up as a sort of corollary question, a secondary question is that if you don't have to do that, what happens sort of next? Do you say, am I absolutely sure that not having Internet of Things and having hard thermometers and hard things and getting things out and writing data in your book, is that going to be good? Am I absolutely sure that's so? Now, you're absolutely sure that's so if you turn that around, if there is not one person in the market who can be a market leader and adopt it. As long as everyone does the same thing, it's all okay. But what happens when one country, one group starts to move forward? Can this technology thing is that what is happening is that we're creating the opportunity cost of not developing in a competitive environment. That's the fundamental core driver. And so one of the things I'm trying to point out is that from your view, basically, people often see themselves, teachers included, are not a producer, but they're not a technology producer, they're a technology consumer. And they think, they get the idea that they're using a technology is their creation of technology. It's different. So what they have to do is they have a series of things that they've got to do, and they've got a certain amount of money, and they can say, do I buy something new or do I upgrade something? And the reason, if you buy something and you've made a decision, there's going to be a window of time where you don't want to upgrade, you've just done. But after this period of time, the overall environment, behavioural environment, will have changed such that what you're doing is no longer competitive. That is, you are, say, spending time arriving early for a train, say, for instance. You will know, because you don't know, there's a cost for not knowing information, and that cost is is not there if the information is not available. Suddenly, if you make the information available to some, you're creating a hidden cost to everybody else. Sort of this creeping negative process going forward here. So from yourself, you have to watch and you react. But from the person coming in, they understand that this new technology will create suddenly a burden. So, and will only create a burden, not instantaneously. It's when people adopt it. And so the bottom line is that this person, Roberta Nesnub, is telling the people that, saying, look, you can do it, and at the cost of absorbing this is a lower cost. Now it's a lower, so a lot of this, there's this idea of a singularity of all these things happening. The more you know things, the more things come in. And I think that's perhaps the opposite thing of happening. If you look at education, it's lagging behind, not keeping up. It's sort of resisting this process, and it's almost because of this process this is going forward. This is your singularity, that is the rate of progress begets a faster rate of progress. Singularities, particularly with artificial intelligence, it's the point of no return. That's when artificial intelligence starts to build its own artificial intelligence. You know, once that happens, it's just a matter of pouring in coal in this end, you know, fuel, you know, energy for the circuits one end. At the other end, it starts to grow itself. There's people out of it, and in a sense, this happens on many levels. It's called the training or the experience effect. That says that the cost of produce the first unit, to produce the second unit is either 90% or 80%, something like that. The next produce. So if you say after 10 years, the cost has come down by 10%. In the next 10 years, what will happen is that your production rate will accelerate, say by a factor of 2, and will come down by 20%. Now, coming down by 20% will increase the production rate of it, the experience effect, and you'll actually just get a real sudden plunge in the cost of doing things. So that's one example of these revolutions coming in on top of each other. So the costs of these things are going down. So it's not necessarily the evil person creating the opportunity. The opportunity is created by this technology process and stuff like that. Now there's these sort of standard opportunities that if, you know, we make, you know, transport more efficient and stuff like that. But there is a sudden change, a market disruptor. And disruptive technique is, say, for Uber, is these small time players. Uber, 3D printing, all this distributed manufacturing is a sort of major concept. So along that, the distributed manufacturing with the added benefit of training is that you can train people in electronics, and what they produce is this component. This is a sudden component. So someone's bought a car and now they're earning money by Uber and it's positioning. So overall, the transport sector has shrunk, I suppose. Hopefully, if it's more efficient, we've got less cars carrying more people, more places, so overall it's more efficient, but it's hopefully got more efficient. Obviously, it's going to be more efficient, it's got to do more with less resources. So it's to move across. So that's one of those things across. Now the issue is that the technological issues are not the major issues here. the major issues lie somewhere else. It's in the organization and the structuring of the information and the organization and structure there. And the point is that we're not out to convince a particular group of teachers. We're out there to hang out the shingle, as it's so to speak, see the first adopter and start the revolution coming forward. So the revolution is twofold. One is the cheap components and being able to have something a product flexible which can feed off these cheap components. A business model that can do that. The second one is a business model is it's being produced inside schools. So we've got those basic business models come forward to provide it, and then it goes to, it's a process of, we get the cheap components of flexibility, lined up with production in schools, lined up with a sudden availability and mobility in the market to lead to a revolution. That's the actual process to go through. So I might write that up as the way to go forward. So that being said, I'll come and try and write that up. And of course, I've got to start reading you guys some New Scientists. So I hope that makes sense. So the typical thing is, one of the things is that I'm a research scientist, so I don't research history. I don't study something that someone else needs to know to do. I actually am out there trying to reconceptualize the process. And so we're stuck at the moment. And so I have this process. One is that we have a business model which can hoover up cheap, ultra cheap components and repurposes them and give a life, a business model, a life to ensure that's okay. Then I have a process where the manufacturing, it's distributed manufacturing, 3D printing, manufacturing schools, community hub building, educational building, to go through. And then finally that it's light and easy. If you don't want to do it, and you know, like, so everyone in Australia doesn't want to do it, someone in Vanuatu, someone in Sri Lanka might want to do it. And because it's going to happen anyway, it really is no skin off my nose or anyone's nose. It's sort of like you're living in a house and the roof is going to go, and you're in a roofing company, and you can go up to someone and you can say, look, your roof has got to be repaired, and you'll probably be best off repairing it before there's any major leaks and it doesn't destroy the property value of your property. However, if you don't want to do it, that's your own decision. I can only do so much. It's a free country. It's a market. So you've got all these market forces come across, and it's caused essentially the market process is the ability to swap resources onto people who will do, and you have to really respect what people do because they're relating on information that you don't have. So the great thing is that the market has got distributed information, distributed things, and essentially it has a way of rewarding the right decision overall. That's how it operates. So here, there's not a huge effort to actually bash down the door and get people to do it. It's the nature of the market, and it's the nature of the market that the person has a behavior, a market-driven technology evolution behavior, individual, but all those individuals will be different. You know, that's and there is going to be a fast adopter who, in doing it, you know, part of the calculation is what everyone else is doing, you know, whatever else. But when something has a greater capability, they will do it. And then you put this in with the learning or experience effect. They will pay a higher premium to get it done. They will get a reward from it by market position in the market. So they pay a premium for position in the market. Then the next people don't pay that position. They don't have the premium, but they don't have the expense. They haven't bought, you know, their second, third place in the market. And that's good for them. They operate at lower costs. It means that they've probably got more money to flex here, or they're less competitive anyway. So there's no point being a competitive way going out here. Okay, I've got to go. Thanks a lot.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.